So, hi. Yeah, and I thought we're sort of on the same page here because, tricky times, and let's not get political. This isn't political. Let's not talk about any candidates or anything, but this is a tough time. I get it, many levels. And, we have fear. And we can identify with those, we can identify people who we think are perpetrators, who cause the problems, and then we can feel enmity towards them. And that's where it gets difficult. But so I got a quote here from Jesus and from the Buddha, which have this remarkable similarity. And this is what I read at Northlake that brought her in. So Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, he said, "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." And then there's this amazing sutta, the simile of the saw, which I read before, where the Buddha says, "Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them, with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus." So, kind of a high bar in both cases, but how amazing, it can seem impossible, right? To cultivate loving kindness towards those whose actions we find abhorrent. Some of us, and I don't want to, we can't assume, let's not assume political alignment, because I have been surprised many times in this particular situation, so I don't want to go there. But in either case, in any case, this is what happens for folks. And so on an ultimate level, these two masters are asking us to go way beyond that and to have loving kindness for these beings that are difficult. And just let me say, because this is something that I know Susan cares about a lot, this cultivation of loving kindness as the sort of ultimately what we have to do is be loving toward all beings, but it has nothing to do with inaction. And if any of us are called to do action, say against climate change or in favor of a political candidate, do it. But if we do take action, let's do it from a perspective of loving kindness, which recognizes that any being along the way is someone who can awaken and who has the same potential that we do. And that's kind of the trick. That's the magic to this. And I'll mention Martin Luther King later, but these great beings, the Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King, Thich Nhat Hanh, Nelson Mandela, they manifested, they took action, but kept kindness in their hearts. That's what's incredible. That's what we're called to do. So it's not an either-or. And this is kind of a heavy lift, but that's how we get stronger, kind of like Jesus was talking about. It's easy to love those that are easy to love. It's harder to love those not easy to love. I learned a lot about this back. I used to be a journalist. Some of you know I was a journalist. And the very nature of working on stories is you have to listen to people. And I was in this constant kind of interplay with people. And the very nature of a story usually meant there were two people in opposition and they thought each other was wrong. And you had to listen to them and find out how it looked from each person's side to be able to do a story and see where it went and put something together that both of them would feel was at least fair or they'd been heard. or what was said about their position was reflected. So I just got constantly stretched from that. And I also learned a lot, because I married into a family with some very conservative people in this case, and at least my father-in-law was also an incredibly smart conservative person with a great sense of humor. So, I mean, he knew 10 times more about U.S. history than I ever began to. You know, so it was kind of like it stretched me. It stretched me, and it's keep stretching me to be in these kind of situations. So I don't want to talk about, you know, politics tonight, because that's not the point. The point is, what can we learn? How can we grow? The very things that, you know, Goldie was talking about and Carol was talking about ways to bring light into the middle of difficulty, and then how we navigate that. And in a sense, the core of the issue from our Dharma point of view is that all sentient beings can awaken to Buddhahood. And we totally get that. We really get that in our hearts. Then that changes our relationship with someone with whom we would disagree, because they can awaken the Buddhahood also. So there's no, you know, intrinsically evil person. There's this quote I often say, the mind is clear, luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. It's sort of, this, for me, this beautiful quote from the suttas, from the numerical discourses. It kind of captures it. Because it's this incredible simplicity. There's obscurations that block the luminosity of mind. And that's what happens in mindful practice. You know, become aware of these things. They unwind themselves. They get less sticky. And slowly, slowly, we're getting clearer to the luminous nature. But when we really think about that, it's like when we do our own practice, and often, you know, how do I say? Often we grew up kind of neurotic because we had a bunch of complications and we thought they were us, and then we thought we could never change them, and we thought that's me and I'm a mess and in the story. But then the more we get, develop our mindfulness, we start to see, oh, that came from somewhere and it had some cause and I can see it attenuating, or it's not intrinsically me, it's got causes and conditions. And we just learn all these different factors are not inherently us. Which is in practice also we learn about other people with whom we disagree, the factors, and maybe, you know, from journalism, if they have a very different view, maybe it came from somewhere. It's hard for us to understand, but that doesn't mean it didn't come from somewhere, and it doesn't mean there's not something actually reasonable about it. If you could just get into their skin, get into their entire gestalt of how they grew up, it might all of a sudden make a whole lot of sense. I mean, I've had that experience with talking to people that I'm in a very different political place from, and if I really try to listen, I start to go, oh, I can see how you see it that way, you know? So that's important work here in 2024. And, you know, I guess, how do I say, the confidence on the path is that as we journey on the path and it becomes clearer over time that the things that keep us from seeing clearly, the things that keep our intuition from happening naturally, they're mutable. They change. They start to thin, you know, or the traumas that we thought just defined us over time, especially when we're aware, and kind of like Eric was saying, we're aware of the experience and not being hung up on the content. And it's like, oh, that experience again, and it just starts to unpack it and untangle it. And that just brings great compassion, because you realize that's the case for everybody. And so when I think of someone who seems really difficult to me, whether that person be a political person or someone I bump up against in the neighborhood or whatever, I start to look. You know, almost like, look, where's that coming from, this thing that's bothering me? Of course, also, where's it coming from in me that's bothered by that person? That's the other thing to look at, to be sure. But you start to kind of look in, you know, just rest in a kind way, in a listening way, and just like kind of hold people and try to understand, try to feel, was it, you know, maybe it's their childhood, maybe their parents from another life. I was reading about Adolf Hitler, and his mother died when he was 17. And it was traumatic for him. He was very close to his mother. She died when he was 17. His father was very difficult. Who knows? You know? Who knows who he became, how much that was part of it. And one thing I said, you know, when you start to do that and go back, I think one of the things when we've concretized someone as evil or a negative person, to start to wonder what kind things might they have done. That if we can see those kind things, then we can start to think about the person differently, because they're not a solid object of evility. They're a complicated person. For instance, Stalin and Mao Zedong were both very kind to their mothers. They loved their mothers dearly. They really took care of their mothers in their mother's later life. And a very kind, you know, provided for them and all kinds of stuff. It made me wonder about my own mother. Man, was I that kind? I don't know. You know, and that's Stalin and Mao Zedong. So you just take this in, and it kind of broadens us out, and we need to do that. You know, and that's part of what our Dharma practice here in 2024, with all the divisions, can help with. So in terms of loving kindness, because that's what we're talking about, especially with the Buddha's second one, to develop loving kindness towards being, it's good to not confuse loving kindness with in love with, because they kind of sound the same, and we can get them really confused in our culture, but they're very different. Because in love with means we like someone. There's some kind of simpatico. You know, we're giving something, but we're getting something. It's a kind of a, that's how couples dance. They dance. That's cool. In terms of the second foundations of mindfulness, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, if we love someone, there's pleasant there. And that's part of the payoff. That's part of the, how it all evolves. That's how people, you know, spend a lifetime together. Because there's something loving that happens. But it is a pleasantness that is part of what makes it work. And, you know, if people go off the rails in their relationships, or it becomes extremely unpleasant, people sometimes get divorced. Or they work it out. Or something. But they kind of there's got to be some kind of pleasant somewhere to make it work. Or it probably wouldn't. And that's the in love with part. And Jesus said, I mean, I think it's so amazing the way he pointed that out. He says, I'm going to add a word here. If you love only those who love you, what reward will you get? He's just nailing that. Are not even the tax collectors doing that? They love people they love. And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? So it really makes us look deeply. I think what Goldie was talking about, you know, the woman and the kind of, you had to push through some layers there, like, oh, maybe they won't like me. And then she thought you didn't like her, you know, and you both got through it. That's so great. I'm so glad you did that. So we gotta take brave steps sometimes. It's pretty cool. Sometimes I think, and this isn't I think Bill Franzel says this, a goodwill can be a better word than loving kindness, because it's so clearly apart from this question of liking and not liking. It's something you can just kind of cultivate or emanate, or pleasant and not. And it's an attitude that, you know, can ultimately have nothing to do with liking a person. And it's how the Buddha would turn toward a being, which really offers us perspective. And I'm very humble. I got to say, I find myself liking people and not liking people, and then I got to go, wait a minute, and try to step up, because it's so instinctive in us to turn towards the ones we like, that are fun, that are cute, that are amusing, that are whatever, and not the ones that we think might not be that. And so to really kind of go deeper. I've been around the Dalai Lama, you know, just a little bit, but you can see he does not see the distinctions of pleasantness and attractiveness and not and all those things. He just doesn't see it. It's crazy. He just sees this being, you know, if it's a leper or a handsome movie director from Italy, they're the same. It's pretty amazing. Joseph Goldstein says about this, One of the unique aspects of metta, which is loving kindness in Pali. Sorry, Carol. Loving kindness, metta. There you go. We were talking about this earlier. I'm sorry. I'm not being catty. One of the unique aspects of metta is that it does not make distinctions among beings. When we feel love mixed with desire, this feeling is always for a limited number of people. We may love or desire one person, or maybe two or three at a time, or maybe several in series. But does anyone in this world desire all beings? So I want to touch on a few great beings and how they've acted towards those who were unpleasant, because that's sort of where the rubber hits the road that we're kind of exploring tonight. I bet, for some of us, there are some people that seem unpleasant to us out there, in politics, God knows what, whatever. And so here's some great beings and how they worked it. Dalai Lama, for decades, he has suffered, left in 1959, fled Tibet, over the mountains, hiding from the Chinese on the way out. And forgive me, this is not anything bad about Chinese people. According to some estimates, I did some research, 1.2 million Tibetans died at the hands of the Chinese government between 1959 and 1979. 1.2 million people in his country. And during that period, 90% of the Tibetan monasteries were destroyed, and the number of monastics declined by 93%. So a lot of those people who died were monastics. So, if the Dalai Lama was bitter or traumatized or angry or thinking in terms of retribution, one could understand that. But he doesn't. And I've been around him and I've heard, because like my antenna up are about this, and I've read about it too, he's no longer the political leader of Tibet, but the way he responds to the whole question of, so he no longer has to do boundaries about the political positioning with the government, which he used to. But in terms of Chinese people and the whole and the Chinese governments and the people who did this, his first response is always a deep sense of compassion. I've read it, I've heard him say it, just feeling compassion for the amount of karma that they have brought upon themselves. It's truly genuine, it's amazing, Just feeling this sadness for what may happen to them in future lifetimes. That's pretty amazing, feeling that compassion. And the second is a real genuine sense of supporting Chinese Buddhist practitioners. He just goes out of his way. A bunch of years ago, in 2018 or something, I was in Dharamsala when they did the March teachings, where he does these teachings where people gather. And they have simultaneously translated into all these different little FM radios, so you can hear what he's saying. But he pulled all these Chinese monastics, he had them sit right in front of the throne, and was just being really kind to them. I think partly because they would feel, a little ostracized, or they could, if something wasn't overtly invited in a warm way, they could feel a little difficult considering some historical situations. So just this great kindness is pretty amazing. And it's worth thinking how we can navigate that, how we can navigate something similar. Martin Luther King, he's a master of returning love for hatred, because in his lifetime, he was heckled, he was spat on, he was arrested, he was beaten, and he was killed. And he never stopped cultivating loving kindness. In 1957, he cited the words of Jesus in a speech, and he said that the words of Jesus, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, that do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you. He referenced it, and he brought this to the present, where he said, and there's a quote part, let me hasten to say that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command. So I think he's talking about the same thing in the Sermon on the Mount. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. He realized that it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you. He realized that it was painfully hard, pressingly hard, but he wasn't playing. Point being, he's saying, yeah, it's really, really hard, and we got to do it. We got to cultivate that. But, we cultivate. It's a practice. We practice. We cultivate. That's what we're doing. It's not like you're wrong if you don't do it or if you feel a flicker of anger or a whole bunch of anger about someone with whom you disagree politically or whatever, but keep working it, Just keep working it. And then lastly, for those of you who read the Nikayas, there's a really incredible, very long one. It's in the Digha Nikaya, like long discourses, number two, number two, so it's easy to remember, called the Fruits of the Contemplative Life. And this one just blows my mind, because the Buddha just shows how compassionate he are. And the backstory is that he's talking. This is directed towards the person who murdered one of the Buddha's oldest and best friends. And that person, I'm not going to pronounce, I'm going to botch the translation, Ajatasattu. That's not that bad. Ajatasattu. Okay, there you go. That's pretty good. He murdered his father, Bimbisara, who was one of the Buddha's very first patrons. He even recognized the Buddha before the Buddha was awakened. He saw him before he was awakened. He was so struck by him. And they had a long dialogue, and he went back and forth and was around Bimbisara a lot. And then his son, creepily enough, partly because he was urged to do so by the Buddha's very difficult cousin, Devadatta, the son overthrew his father, put him in jail. The father starved to death, very close to where the bamboo grove is. I've been there. It's just like 5 miles away. The Buddha probably heard, was aware. He probably walked by the prison where Bimbisara was starving to death. It's pretty amazing. So it was a coup. There was a coup. Puts any of our government situations to shame. It was a flat-out coup, which we just got arguments about whether voting was right or not. But what's amazing about this thing is, so Ajatasattu, he's in the suttas, it's very long because it's a long discourse, he has a sense of unease. He's like, he starts off, he's just feeling unease, and he talks to his ministers and says, who can I talk to? I'm just not feeling very good about my life. And they said, well, talk to this guy, talk to that guy. Then they said, no, not them, not them. And they said, well, talk to the Buddha. And he said, oh, that's a good idea. It's kind of bizarre because he'd known the Buddha since he was a child, that this was a surprise, but whatever. So he goes and talks to the Buddha. And the Buddha gives this incredibly long, this is why it's really worth reading, this long and rich exposition on the path of awakening, but completely talking to the prince the whole time, or the king, the whole time in it. It's really wonderful to read. And he urges them onward, and he never says anything about, oh, by the way, you lout who killed your dad. He just pulls them forward into his possibility of awakening. It's the damnedest thing. He just pulls him forward and is incredibly beautiful. It's really worth reading. It just lays out the path in this unique way, in this very interactive way with this person. He keeps saying, what are you thinking? How does this manifest in your life? He's just pulling him. And towards the end, Ajatasattu, something clicks in his heart and he starts regretting what he did, killing his father. And he says, in the sutta, he says, a transgression has overcome me, Lord, in that I was so foolish, so muddle-headed, and so unskilled as to kill my father, a righteous man, a righteous king, for the sake of sovereign rulership. May the Blessed One please accept this confession of my transgression as such, so that I may restrain myself in the future. I think that's so powerful. I mean, for one thing, he saw something, but you can kind of, you know, sometimes people do bad things, and then at some point they unpack it or they realize what they did. And in this case, the Buddha just kept, in some amazing way, just kept lifting the energy so it clarified for this person. So he didn't push him, didn't criticize him, didn't judge him. He pulled him forward just because of his loving kindness. And the Buddha says, his response says, because you see your transgression as such and make amends in accordance with the Dharma, we accept your confession, for it is a cause of growth in the Dharma and discipline of the noble ones when, seeing a transgression as such, one makes amends in accordance with the Dharma and exercises restraint in the future. So he keeps pulling him forward, and he didn't say, oh, yeah, you really did mess. I didn't say that. He just pulls him forward. And what's interesting is that, I didn't include it here, but, and then this happens often when the Buddha is talking to great kings. He'll give them this teaching and they often say, you know what, I got a bunch of appointments, I gotta go. They pretty much say, it's happened about 10 different times in the suttas where they say, I'm very busy, I gotta go. And the Buddha says, as you wish, king. Then after he leaves, he says, if he hadn't done that from this exposition, he would have awakened. So he colored him, he darkened himself by what he did, killing his father. So he didn't awaken at that time, although supposedly later on he did. But I think it's just a beautiful sense of, you know, this guy messed up by any stretch. He did a really bad thing. And the Buddha just welcomed him, saw his potential, and eventually, story goes, he awakened. Didn't even, yeah, so, you know, we don't know how this happens. But it does happen. So this metta, this other way of looking at this, it's in Pali, the Pali language, it's close to, I don't know Pali really, I mean I don't, I know some, a few words, but the Pali word mitta, M-I-T-T-A, which means friend. So they're kind of kissing cousins, just friend. And Gil Fronsdal, very wonderful Western teacher, translates metta as gentle friendliness, which is another lovely way to think of it, gentle friendliness that you could cultivate toward everybody, even those who seem very wrong. So it's just this goodwill wish that all beings, any beings, be happy and safe. And the stretch, you know, the place where we need to work, and it's a beautiful journey, is to find the ones that are hard. And that's, you know, we're not going to do traditional metta practice, but as you know, you cultivate phrases and you go from an easy person to a neutral person to a difficult person. Or maybe we will. And that's how the arc goes, because it makes you stretch and it makes you go deeper and look at the ways that you've got them categorized as something intrinsically wrong. So we can do that. I know some friends that have pictures of political leaders whom they violently disagree with on their altars. And they, yeah, right? And they offer them loving kindness, and they cultivate goodwill toward them. In the Metta Sutta, the Buddha uses a metaphor of parenting. And I think that's another way we can think about this. He says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, close your eyes for a minute and... Where's Josh? Josh and his, yes, and his new child. But imagine yourself as a mother. And then turning towards each being in the political world out there as your child, your only child, and cultivating that kind of compassion toward that person that you probably don't like at all when you watch the news. But the Buddha is saying, every person, hold them as your only child. And cultivate, because, you know, we do know only childs often, they go off, do things their parents don't like, they get all kinds of trouble, they grow up, they become difficult. But there's a place in which the mother still holds that child. And we can do that, cultivate that for all beings. And just to shift a tiny bit, you know, as Buddhist practitioners, we look at life in a very simple way. The Buddha always said, I teach two things, suffering and the end of suffering. Dukkha and the end of dukkha, which is freedom. You know, it gets bigger and bigger, but suffering and the end of suffering. So if you look at it that way, the journey here is we want every being to be free of suffering, to find liberation, including us. But that's what the journey is for every being, to end their suffering. You ever seen a picture of those thousand-armed Chenrezigs? A big Tibetan tanka, and they have like 1,000 arms like that. They're pretty amazing. And each arm has an eye. Each hand has an eye in it. So there's 1,000 arms of compassion, seeing all the beings in the world with great compassion. It's really moving. And with so many eyes and so many hands, that means they're seeing every being with compassion. Even the mess-ups. Even the sons of Bimbisara and difficult people, them too. And so it the compassion thing, it takes it like one more step, because loving kindness is just wishing that people be happy, you know, wishing goodwill toward them. Compassion is wishing that they be free from suffering, that they be liberated from the very things, really, that would cause them to do anything damaging to anybody else. Just like the king, you know, eventually he was liberated from the compulsions that had him do that heinous act against his father. So when we look at this in terms of compassion, then it's a broader field. Loving kindness and compassion are closely linked and they're worth kind of looking at together, because they work off of each other. Loving kindness is just this goodwill, and then compassion is wanting beings to be free from suffering, to be liberated, to reach nibbana eventually. And just, you know, the more we evolve in this direction, the ways we're not awakened yet, speaking for myself anyway, and other beings aren't awakened yet that we may disagree with, it becomes not as different as we thought. You know, we all got stuff we grasp on, we got things we push away from, we got graspings and desires and animosities, and these other people that are doing things that we don't like have the same. It's been striking, again, without getting political, but I try to find out how people that I really disagree with are thinking, and I realize there's a lot of fear, you know, in other parts of the country. I mean, I've talked to people. I know some people that the mere thought of going to Capitol Hill in Seattle completely freaks them out. Some people in Idaho, big tough guys with like big 4x4s and chainsaws, like, oh my God, I would never go to Seattle. It's fucking dangerous there. Dude, there's like 3-year-old children playing in little parks. It's really okay. But they feel like it's this horrible, horrible place where it's just absolutely out of control. And so, you know, you take that in. It's like, okay, it starts to make more sense why we're having so divided. It's pretty, we have some property in Idaho, so I rub up against these interesting people, but it's like, wow, very interesting. So this is the embracing attitude of loving kindness, and we're really called to do that. And it doesn't mean we can't take action. It helps us take action. You know, it helps us, so we're going to be an activist. It helps us understand where other people are coming from that just seem like, you know, we can see them, they're just concrete, they're evil, they're terrible, bad. Then you're defeated. But if they're an actual human being that you could communicate with and that has their own way of looking at things that may seem foreign to you, but they're still a human being. And that's a better way, more effective way to actually be active, is to breathe them in. You know, and we... It may seem hard to imagine that these difficult people could really awaken someday, some lifetime. But then we think about ourselves. I mean, how do we feel about ourselves and our ability to awaken? You know, it can seem like, really? Me? I don't think so. I'm just a wreck. You know? So it's not that different in some ways. I mean, it's kind of like humbling. Humbling, the way we see ourselves and how far away it may seem to us, or how difficult the journey. And then you look at someone else. Okay, we're all on the journey here together. So it's kind of like we're all in this boat of samsara together. Then we can kind of love each other. At least we can start loving, and maybe they'll, you know, reciprocate. You never know. So, Jesus and the Buddha, you know, they had such compassion for others and such understanding of the limitless potential of others because they were awakened. That's how I look at them as two awakened beings. So let's just, if that works. You know, they're awakened, and because they were awakened, because the scales had fallen away, they could see how other beings can be. It's like really obvious to them. And that's why they were so relentless about no enemies, no enemies. Love them, love everybody, because they were awakened so that anybody that would seem like an enemy didn't seem that way to them. And sort of putting ourselves into that skin can really help us stretch ourselves. So So I think it's one of the gifts of difficult times is it's stretching us, you know, to recognize nature of mind, to recognize our awakened potential. Let's sit for a minute.